I think we've got a real catch in our guest speaker tonight, who's going to talk to us tonight about academic power is moving east. So I hand over to you, Tayo. Thanks very much.
John, thank you very much. Can you hear me okay, or do I need to project my voice more?
They'll tell you.
I'm very grateful to be reminded that I am indeed a refugee of Brexit. Brexit is one of those topics that's no longer talked about in the UK media at all because it's been overtaken by COVID, of course. And the ineptitude of the British government in dealing with Brexit has now been replaced by the ineptitude of dealing with COVID. When you think of how many unfortunate souls have passed in the UK because of that decision to initially adopt herd immunity in the UK, which was a bit of a folly, and then replaced the approach parts of the world were taking, which was lockdowns. It's a shame that we suffered. I keep saying we because my family's still in London. And so being here in the relative security, health security of Perth and WA, I had a very sharp contrast in what I was hearing from my family in London as they were having to literally lock down and not leave the house at all for fear of the virus. So we're grateful, of course, to the fact that we have health security here. But we have achieved that health security here because we've closed the borders. Not just the international borders, we've closed the interstate border. And in my recent interactions with government, we've been talking about, well, how can we plan for the reintroduction of international students back into WA and particularly into UWA? Because as you know, Australian universities in particular, and also in other key Western countries, are heavily reliant on international students for their ability to then invest in research and development, for business models that allow them to attract top academic talent across the globe. And I make that segue because that's the underlying reason why academic power is moving east. It's because the Asian countries, have looked at what we in Australia or the UK or Canada or New Zealand, even parts of continental Europe, have embraced a more commercial model that underpins higher education. Now, we can debate, perhaps over a Chinese meal, whether that's the right model for a esteemed institution of higher learning. Because I'm sure many of you can cast your minds back when universities were much smaller, when a much smaller percentage of the population went to university. That university was not seen as a stepping stone necessarily to a job, but was to broaden your mind, to educate your intellect. That's now changed. You have governments like the UK government. Tony Blair made it an avowed aim that 50% of the population would go to university. And indeed, that has now been achieved. It was achieved literally pre-COVID, just before the virus outbreak. 50% of school leavers were going to university. What did the education minister say? We don't think this is the right approach. We actually think that more of the population should consider going down a vocational route rather than going to university. And that's, again, signaling to the university sector across the globe, of which there are nearly 30,000 universities. 30,000 universities. China alone, pre-COVID, was built one university a week. Very easy to build the universities. It still takes 10 years to develop a professor. Still takes that time to develop the human talent that goes with that infrastructure. And so there is now a movement that's now questioning, well, what is the role that a university should play? And should it be, does it revert back to that traditional model? Does it stick with the path that it's currently pursuing? Or is it somewhere in between? And I suggest to you, when we look at the Australian government's response to COVID and in particular to universities, that they are suggesting that we need to look at our model as well. That perhaps we as universities should not be so reliant on international students, in particular on Chinese students. That we should perhaps look to have a more smaller size and shape and consider what an appropriate business model is. Now, I give that as context because the elite universities that are emerging in Asia do not have that hindrance of finance, do not need to go and recruit from across the globe to be able to sustain their level of growth, their ability to grow their research and development, and indeed their ability to attract top academic talent. And the question is, why? Well, the underlying reason is indeed the fact that Asia has economically been growing for a number of years, two decades at least. And we have seen the rapid rise of countries like China and India. Their economies have boomed. Yes, there are great disparities between the rich and the not rich. But what we have seen is the emergence of a growing middle class. Indeed, if you look at India alone, its middle class numbers over 300 million. That's more than the population of the United States. Genuinely middle class. They can afford to travel overseas. And they can afford quality health care. And indeed, they can afford to send their children for international higher education. And it's those countries that have been fueling the international student movement that we have witnessed over the past two decades in particular. And that rise of countries like China onto the global stage, because they have exported so many students across the world, has given them access to the blueprint for developing world-class universities. There are thousands and thousands of Chinese students who stayed on in their countries, Indians as well, before that Malaysians, who became academics and rose through the ranks of their adopted institutions. And then who in turn would come back to their home countries and help nurture and develop their institutions. And that's a pattern that's been repeating itself in different countries around Asia. But if we think of the fact that right now the climate is concerned at the impact of China, its more muscular approach on the international stage, whether it's the South China Sea Islands, its border dispute with India, and you see the response of the West, and here I talk of the Five Eyes in particular, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, US, and UK, and their sort of unanimity in saying, enough, it's time to draw a line in the sand. And you see then the effects of that, the way that Huawei as a company is being dealt with, TikTok is now the latest Chinese company that's being targeted. Against a backdrop of a trade war between the US and China, you're seeing the tectonic plates shifting in that relationship as China, Xi Jinping, adopting a more how he views China on the world stage. Indeed, you talk to many Chinese people, they will say they're rightfully reclaiming their position on the world stage. That for centuries pre-colonial, China was a dominant regional power, and that they are now rightfully reclaiming that. Much like you hear that narrative now in, say, India as well. So that narrative of economic power is well known. The less well-known aspect is that academic power is also moving east. That Asia has asserted itself in many different spheres, not just the academic and the economic, culturally. The rise of Korean K-pop, soap operas. These are all manifestations of a more confident Asia, and as John mentioned, the Asian century is often the term that's used to describe the 21st century. But it's interesting that as these countries develop their spheres of influence, there is challenge that is being posited across the Western countries. And that's often coming out of academic circles as well. So when one debates initiatives like the Chinese One Belt, One Road initiative, and the fact that Africa is deemed now a sphere of influence of China because it's invested so much in infrastructure in that continent, what often gets missed is that countries like Japan and China have been offering thousands and thousands of scholarships to students from those nations in Africa and other parts of, whether it's the One Belt, One Road initiative and so on. And they're doing that with that purpose of trying to forge their academic base, but equally to try and assert their influence in key parts of the world. It was a similar pattern that our institutions followed as well. You know, if you look at the rise of American universities, it has benefited from those Chinese and Indian academics. If you look at the UK, it has benefited from the fact that at my former institution, nearly half of the academics were from outside of the United Kingdom. Here at UWA, we have a healthy 30% of our faculty that are from outside of Australia. And that's an important facet that often gets missed about academia, is that it doesn't really recognize borders, and nor should it. So let me describe some of the key characteristics of why I think that academic power has shifted, or rather is shifting east and will continue to move in that direction. I'm going to focus on seven different countries because I think there is a sort of 2 to 3 tiers within Asia. Tier one, you have countries like Singapore, Japan, Korea, Hong Kong, China, India, Singapore, I've mentioned, Taiwan is the other one. Let's call that sort of the first division. You then have another tier of Asian countries that have adopted a much smaller approach, but are equally desirous of having elite institutions, and that's typically countries in parts of the Middle East like Qatar and the UAE. Malaysia, they tend to build satellite campuses of Western institutions as a way of trying to attract academic talent. If we focus on that first division, first of all, what are the characteristics that describe why they have been successful in growing their institutions? I should qualify that, in growing their elite institutions. Because there's a big disparity. As I said, China has nearly 3,000 universities just in China. Not all, the vast majority of them, I would say, are not very good. Indeed, similar situation in the United States. We think of the Ivy League. Then there's a cluster of universities, probably about 50-odd after that, that are world-class, very decent. The rest, pretty average to mediocre. What countries like Singapore, Hong Kong have done is they've focused in on typically 2 to 3 universities. So in Hong Kong, it's Hong Kong University, it's the Chinese University of Hong Kong, it's Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. The government focuses on them. In China, Peking University and the alma mater of Xi Jinping, Tsinghua University, are the focus. But they have an elite group, the so-called C9, 9 universities that they heavily invest in, and they have government schemes to continue to grow those institutions. In China, they call it the latest iteration is called double first class. Double first class means you're aspiring to be first class as an institution, and you're also aspiring to have first class disciplines within your institution. And I would suggest to you that it's an unlimited source of funding available from the Chinese Ministry of Education to grow those institutions and make them elite, because it is seen as a badge of honor for those countries. Japan, if I think back to when I started in higher education, Japan was seen as the preeminent Asian country. The University of Tokyo was seen as the number one Asian institution. The University of Tokyo is way down. It's been overtaken by Chinese universities, by Singaporean universities, by Hong Kong universities. And Japan has really struggled to try and address that. Taiwan is another example. The National Taiwanese University, one of the elite institutions. When you thought as to who to collaborate with in Asia, you would typically think of that, or, as I said, Tokyo, or Kyoto to a lesser extent. That landscape has completely shifted because they've been usurped by this real rise of Chinese, Singaporean, Korean institution. And each of those countries has set up models to ensure that they continue to grow and rise in the world university rankings. So it's a avowed aim of China that it must have at least 2 universities in the world 10. That's a hard thing to do. UWA is in the world top 100. And there isn't much within that top 100, because it takes investment to actually achieve that level of rank. But that model has been shaken because of that limitless finance that has been directed towards these prestige projects of national governments in Asia. So National University of Singapore, Nanyang Technological University, two universities in Singapore, are now seen as the blueprint for how you become an elite university. And they achieved that in the space of 10 years. And how did they do that? Initially, the plan was to invite visiting academics from Western institutions. Spend a month in Singapore. Teach a course, undertake some research. We'll offer you some research funding as well. And gradually they built that up so that they could attract you for longer periods of time, and there was more research funding available. And the biggest change in Singapore was the foundation of the National Research Foundation in 2006. And that was the Singaporean government saying, we do not just want to be manufacturing products for the world, but we would like to rise in the value chain and actually be developing our R&D facilities, our capabilities. And so they set up this National Research Foundation, the NRF, that is now probably one of the most richest research funds in the world. In the last 5 years alone, they have spent $16 billion on research. And if you think that that's a large number, that pales into insignificance when you compare it to China, which, if it wasn't for COVID, I would have suggested in 2020, China would have overtaken the US in total R&D spend. China's already the world's largest register of patents for inventions. Its research citations, i.e. the power, the strength of its research, has been rising increasingly over the last decade in particular. And in certain disciplines like chemistry and engineering, they are elite and world class. Their research gets cited by academics across the globe. And that's an important point to keep registering here, that the best research in the world is international research. It has the highest, what's called, field weighting citation impact, much more than domestic research. What that means is that when you collaborate with an institutional partner in another country, you typically produce a higher quality of research that is cited by others much more and has greater impact, societal impact, than domestic research. And China's been very aware of that, as indeed has Korea, as has India. And they've focused in on developing that R&D capability. And they took a leaf out of Singapore's book and said, okay, fine, we will look to do the same. But for a variety of reasons, not least the fact that China's not as an attractive destination, or was not as an attractive destination as, say, Singapore a decade or so back, struggled to really attract that talent. And so their approach wasn't to attract the talent from across the globe, irrespective of their nationality or background, but was to actually focus on the Chinese diaspora. Those Chinese students who'd stayed on and were working in places like MIT and Stanford and so on, and came up with schemes like the 1,000 Talent Scheme to lure them back to China with very favorable salary packages, almost expat packages, offering them accommodation and cars and all manner of elements to their package. But more importantly, they were offering them typically promotion, start as a head of department, you have the opportunity to grow a department. I remember meeting a very young, must have been, what, 33 to 35 years old, Chinese professor at Tsinghua University who had been tasked with setting up a medical school. That's no mean feat to set up a medical school with hospitals and be able to conduct research. And within the space of a decade, he was able to make that not one of the best medical schools in China, but a very good medical school. He would never have had that opportunity in the United States, which is where he had moved from. So it was giving them wonderful career progression opportunities. They were being given limitless research funding, provided with excellent facilities, fully kitted out laboratories with the best equipment. Indeed, every time I used to go to China, of course, they wanted to tour you around a brand new shiny laboratory or hospital or whatever. And yes, they had the best MRI machines and laboratories, but they were still struggling to attract enough academics. And as I mentioned at the start, you can build wonderful facilities, and they do it at rapid speed in places like China, but you cannot speed up the development of an academic, a professor. And that was their challenge. They were still suffering that bottleneck. But China has grown, and I'm focusing on China because that is the preeminent academic power, I would suggest, even within Asia. Singapore, yes, but it doesn't have the scale. Korea, similar story. You know, you have what I call the sky universities, Seoul National, Yonsei, and Korea University. They're elite, they're good. But I would suggest to you the Chinese ones are in almost a different league now. They just have been able to create a formula that attracts into their top universities the best talent from around the world, now not just restricted to the Chinese diaspora. Indeed, a good friend of mine, just again from the UK, wrote to me last week, said, I've accepted a post at a university in China that had partnered with Liverpool. So this is Liverpool Xi'an Jiao Tong University. And I asked him what was the motivation, because once you leave the UK, it's often very hard to then come back into the system. And he said, well, that's no longer the case. I know that if I spend 5 years there, I will be able to rise in terms of my academic profile, in terms of the research collaborations that I will be able to do internationally. And I will not have to worry about budgets like I am doing as a head of department in the UK. I won't have to cut staff. I won't have to worry about the research excellence framework and how am I going to make sure that my department submits enough works for that exercise. He can achieve his academic and career ambitions in a different way that could not have been achieved, I dare say, even 5 years ago. And that's just, again, another indication of how that power has shifted. So it's underpinned by the economic power that these countries have, married to academic talent that they can attract, together with good opportunities for research funding and excellent facilities. Now that's an example of where it's being done well. I'm going to contrast that with a country where it's not being done anywhere near as well, and that's India. Similar rise in terms of its economic trajectory, has excellent institutions like its IITs, the Indian Institutes of Technology, the IIMs, the Indian Institutes of Management, and the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore. They're good institutions, but they're nowhere near high enough in the rankings. And the question is, why not? When you look at the fact that those elite institutions in India typically have a pass mark to gain entry, 98% to 99%, that some of their alumni, particularly the IIT alumni, are now running Silicon Valley. Now look at the head of Google, IIT alum, for example. They've not quite been able to achieve that rapid rise that you have witnessed in places like Singapore or Korea or China. And for a long time, there was a real question mark as to why that wasn't happening. They had all the right ingredients. They've clearly got the talent. They've got those elite institutions with pretty decent infrastructure. And they have access to research funding, more of a collaborative nature. For example, the Newton Fund with the UK or the Australia-India Strategic Fund here. A lot of collaborative research opportunities, but never quite achieving those heights. And again, it's an example of where a country then sees it as a prestige project and says, well, hang on, this can't be right. If we have aspirations, in the case of India, more as a regional superpower, we must have top 100 universities. And so 2 years ago, 3 years probably now, the government there set up what it called Institutes of Eminence, IOEs. And it wanted to have 20 of them, 10 in the public sector, 10 in the private sector. It's quite telling that they still haven't achieved that 20. They're still struggling to identify those institutions, and they're still caught up in red tape and bureaucracy. Now, India's a democracy. Things operate much slower than China, where the Ministry of Education is very much following a 5-year plan. Those institutes of eminence included one that didn't even exist. It was only on paper. It was the brainchild of India's richest man, Mukesh Ambani. And yet, it gained that elite status within India. And it still hasn't been built. They're still working out what disciplines they want there and so on. They've acquired the land just outside of Mumbai. And there was a big hoo-ha as to how this on-paper institution had achieved this golden rank within India. But what's interesting is, again, what you saw is, in this case, a billionaire saying, I am committing X billion dollars to setting up a world-class institution. And that's the pattern that he has adopted from what he's seen in other countries. And indeed, if one casts one's mind back in history, if you think of some of the Ivy League institutions, Stanford is the classic example. That was set up by a very rich man as well, as a legacy project named for his son, Leland Stanford, and has grown over time. And that's the model that India is now pursuing. So the government has recognized that its public institutions tend to be bureaucratic and slow. They tend to be very large. University of Delhi and University of Mumbai have hundreds of thousands of students, thousands of colleges. They're essentially just teaching institutions. But the elite institutions that are emerging, whether they're funded by the Times of India Group or they're funded by an industrialist like Jindal, are the ones that are now becoming the academic powerhouses. They're playing catch up now. But they will achieve that rank. So all of that is a way of highlighting the fact that as that academic power shifts, we as institutions in the West need to evaluate and calibrate our relationships with those institutions, that we need to recognize that we should be engaging in much more research collaboration, much more mobility, collaborative degree programs with these institutions, because the locus has shifted. If I looked at a heat map today of where UWA has most of its research collaborations, unsurprisingly, it's with Europe and North America. There are smatterings in parts of Asia. And if we wish to remain an elite top 100 university, my view is we have to look to continuously reevaluate who we are collaborating with. And therefore, it is important that we forge relationships with some of these elite institutions that have emerged in parts of Asia. And that's against the backdrop, as I said, of the geopolitical landscape, which has presented concern to governments, including our own here in Australia. So you will have noticed that last year the Australian government introduced guidelines for universities in relation to foreign interference. It made a distinction between foreign interference and foreign influence. It argued that Western universities were good vehicles for foreign influence and had engaged in that in other countries and welcomed it here in Australia as well. But what we would not be welcoming of is foreign interference. Now, fair enough. How do you define foreign interference? And that has been almost the poison chalice that the government has given, the federal government has given to universities, because it's told them, you need to police yourselves. And so we have this situation where, here at UWA, just across the hallway, we have the Confucius Institute. And in a sense, we are now being nudged into needing to register this as a foreign government entity that has the potential or may have evidence of foreign interference capabilities. Now, I do wonder if that's actually the case. Confucius Institutes, by and large, teach Chinese. Yes, they promote Chinese culture as well, and you could say it's soft power. But it's no different to what the British Council has been doing in different parts of the world, teaching English, offering British and UK culture. And so it's interesting that we're being asked to look at it in that way. It's interesting that universities have now started needing to record instances of where they feel foreign diplomats are trying to encroach on the freedom of expression within universities. And I've had dealings here in my 12 months with, you know, the Consul General of China wanting to lecture me about Hong Kong and the fact that there were students protesting about what was going on in Hong Kong. Or indeed the Indian Consul General chastising us for daring to invite the Pakistani High Commissioner. These are all instances that have always occurred, right? But now we are being asked to record them as foreign interference. And I worry that that's a slippery slope. But it is a reaction to the geopolitical environment. It is also a reaction to the fact that there's a belief that there is no academic freedom in countries like China, and that we need to protect that academic freedom even more so here. I think that that's too simplistic, and we can talk about that separately because that's an interesting consideration. I want to say a bit about COVID and the impact that that has had and where I think that that will perhaps alter some of that trajectory and growth of universities and academic power in Asia. So COVID, of course, forced all universities across the world to move to online teaching, shutting down campuses, telling students to go home. In the case of Chinese students, not even allowing them to come here to Australia in the first place. So a lot of our Chinese students were stuck. And then we, as universities like UWA, had to rapidly move content online, which was great to see. Academics who had hitherto not been proponents of online learning, suddenly, out of necessity, embracing online technology and converting their lectures for digital delivery. And similarly, universities trying to come up with ways of collaborating and continuing collaboration in the face of travel bans. And what was great to see is that we now have online conferences and webinars. We have online research collaboration. We have virtual mobility for students, which is an interesting concept where you use a platform like Zoom or even WhatsApp to have students engage with each other, which I think is actually a fantastic opportunity to broaden the range of partnerships beyond the usual ones, to have our students interact with, say, students in parts of Africa or South America, where they perhaps wouldn't have felt comfortable traveling for health or security reasons. And conversely, having students in Africa or Latin America engage in collaborations with Australian students through that online format. And I'm very encouraging of that. So you've got that shift, that movement into COVID, the impact of COVID, which has meant that we have embraced those technologies. And I hope that we continue that once there is a vaccine and once there's treatment for COVID. What does it mean for the Australian higher education sector? That's another point. I think the Australian government has decided that it doesn't need to be supporting its universities, even though higher education is the fourth largest export of this country. In WA alone, it's responsible for $2 billion of our GDP. It funds nearly 10,000 WA jobs. But the government decided very early on that it wasn't going to bail out universities as had other countries. It wasn't going to allow universities to be eligible, for example, for JobKeeper. Indeed, each time a university thought that it was eligible, they changed the rules. Three times the rules were changed. And if you listen to Scott Morrison, he talks about them being multi-million dollar enterprises with very well-paid CEOs that should not receive government support. And we have an education minister hinting that the model is broken, that you should not be as reliant on international students, that you should not be as large, and that there's other ways of being and remaining elite. And that's quite telling because as I sort of bring it round to what I started with, there is now that question of how do we engage and compete with Asian universities that have bottomless sources of finance and funding? And perhaps we need to reevaluate what our elite institutions ought to look like, that their size should be smaller, that their shape should be different. And in many ways, I would suggest that that is partly a reaction to the fact that we now understand that we cannot compete with those elite institutions that are emerging in Asia. Now, COVID may slow down the trajectory of their growth because you're not having that flow of people and ideas as much as before. But it will continue unabated, is my argument. So, the question that I want to end with here is, how do we respond to this growing elite of Asian universities? Is it to withdraw and focus on our own and then continue to remain with our existing institutional partners? Is it to reach out to these new elite institutions and collaborate with them? Or do we adopt a middle road, as perhaps our governments are suggesting to us, to be cautious and to worry about potential dual use of technology, to carefully vet all students who are going to places like China? I would suggest that throughout history, education has not known borders. People have always traveled for education, even if one thinks back to the Middle Ages. That desire for knowledge, wherever it may exist in this world, has attracted people to it, and I don't think that that is going to change. I think we have to embrace these institutions, and in fact we have to work with them to help them develop their capabilities as well, because through that engagement and through that collaboration, we will become better as well as institutions. And it would be folly to adopt a route of insularity. I think that that is not a long-term solution. It may buy you votes in the short term, may be popular for various reasons, but in the long term, it is important that we engage and continue to engage with these institutions, because they will, and in some cases have already overtaken us in the rankings, and they will continue to get stronger. And what we'll probably see is that fewer students will want to come to countries like Australia in the long term, let's say 10 years from now, because their middle classes will recognize that they now have elite domestic institutions. And so, yes, I do agree that the the business model here of universities does need to evolve. It can't be right that because of COVID, we have suddenly woken up to the fact, less so here at UWA, but certainly over East, that, you know, for example, UNSW has over $600-700 million shortfall in its budget, that it's now having to, unfortunately, lay off nearly 500 staff to try and minimize the impact of that financial hit. We made hay while the sun shined. Fantastic buildings and infrastructure have been developed across the 40-odd universities in Australia. But we also grew in terms of our international collaborations, and we're better for it. The fact that we have international faculty, the fact that we have international students, makes us better institutions. And it's important that we do not lose sight of that fact. So, the borders are closed, and rightfully so, whilst there are concerns around health security. But at some point, we do need to reopen those borders, and at some point, we do need to signal that we are happy to welcome back students. It cannot be right when our Prime Minister says international students should go home. That's not the message we want to send. That's the kind of message that the American government, which initially was trying to restrict the visa regulation in relation to international students, but then in the face of lawsuits from the likes of Harvard and MIT, reversed its position. We have to be welcoming of that talent. It makes us stronger, not just within the world of academia, but in our economies more generally. We know that. And that mobility, that global talent mobility, is important in academia as much as it is in the world of commerce and industry. So, academic power is rising in the East. It's to be welcomed. We should embrace it. We should engage with it. We certainly need to be supportive of it, and we should see it as a benefit to our institutions. Some of those institutions will become, I dare say, world-class top 10 institutions. The majority will not. But it is important to recognize the drivers behind that growth, and it's economic. And so long as the likes of China, India, Korea, and so on are growing economically, their universities, as a consequence, will continue to grow as well. So, important that we engage, important that we do not look to hinder or stymie their growth, and it's important that we learn the lessons that they will develop in due course, because as they become elite institutions, we will see knowledge transfer of a different kind coming from those elite institutions. We shouldn't shy away from that. We should welcome that. With that, thank you, and I look forward to your questions.
Well, we've certainly covered a lot of ground, and I'm sure there's some very good questions. So, Ash, you'd like us to use this for the questions? So, Molly's got one there. So, questions, please. I've got a question, if I may, and that's about if Professor Mark Beeson was here, our head of, who you know, he's the head of research for the Institute of International Affairs, who works in the humanities. He is no longer welcome in China as far as he's concerned. And, you know, as he would say, proudly sort of centre-leftist academic at that too, and he's worried about getting detained. So that's not a caricature. That's where we are at the moment. So how much is the fault line through the humanities and the liberal arts, if you like, and then this grand sphere of non-humanities learning and academic freedom there that can't really do the state that much damage. So how does that work with China? And second, can I just ask you about Indonesia, Timor-Leste, Papua New Guinea, and some of the links we might look at, because as an institute, we look at links as well. And then I see some questions up there.
Okay. So that's a really good point. I think it's worth emphasizing that when we talk of these elite institutions, they often focus on science and technology, the health sciences, engineering, life sciences, and so on. They're not as interested in developing what we call the arts and humanities or the social sciences, and for obvious reasons that you have alluded to, certainly in the case of China. But it's also because they don't see it as part of their nation building. Now, they want to grow their economies. What are they going to grow that off? It's more engineers, it's more doctors. It's not necessarily more social scientists or philosophers or art historians. Not that they don't have them, the amount of investment in growing those isn't there. Coming to your point around the academic freedom, I think that's a valid point. When we look at what's going on in Hong Kong right now, we're having to reevaluate our relationships with Hong Kong universities because we now worry that what was a bastion of a bubble of commerce and academic freedom isn't quite going to be there. And indeed, we're picking up very early signs that academics are looking to leave Hong Kong. Not just the expat academics, but also local Hong Kong academics as well. So it is a concern. I think this links to the geopolitical environment as well, that China has become much more unforgiving of criticism. It certainly its government has, and it does extend that to academics and particularly to foreign academics in those spaces. But does that mean, therefore, that we should not engage with them? I would still suggest we have to. I think it's important that we do so, recognizing that there are risks associated with that. Now, you'll have some that will say, when we're in their country, we should abide by their rules, and that's fine. Others, quite legitimately, and I will back them and support them, will say, well, no, I stray true to my values, my beliefs, and my opinions, and I will express them irrespective of where I may be. And we, as institutional administrators, have to support both camps, and we do. But I would come back to not wishing to lose sight of the bigger picture and the value that we will benefit from in that overall engagement. So coming to your second part around Indonesia and so on, I think it's important that we do continue to engage. I sit on the board of the Australia-Indonesia Centre, which is a collection of universities both here and in Indonesia who look to collaborate in terms of research. And then, of course, UWA hosts what's called ECHICIS, which is the body that encourages student mobility. And both are suffering at the moment because of COVID. It is simply unsafe for us to send academics or students to Indonesia and to receive them in return. And because the internet is not as widely available in parts of Indonesia, that has meant it's a real challenge for us to continue that engagement and that involvement. But it is interesting that, you know, Indonesia, with its very large population, has not adopted a similar approach to the likes of its neighbors in Singapore and indeed Malaysia to an extent as well, that its elite institution is not as highly ranked, and nor does it really look to achieve that ranking. I think there's more of a focus around developing domestic capability and talent. It's perhaps not as an attractive destination for different reasons for foreign academics to be based there. And what you find is that their middle classes will instinctively send their children overseas. Australia, Singapore, Malaysia, they're right on their doorstep, so that impetus isn't there.
Connor there, and three questions up the front. I think that just about does it.
Okay.
So, Connor, welcome back from France not so long ago.
My question is sort of very similar to one you asked in that regard, is considering the more humanities-based universities, places like Harvard, Sciences Po, Oxford, and all those sorts of places have remained sort of at the top when considering political science and international law. Would you then think that when it comes to actually truly gaining that elite status, that Chinese universities especially will be stymied to some degree? Will they be able to overcome that, given the geopolitical differences? Mm.
The short answer is, and that's a consequence of our rankings bodies that place a premium on disciplines. So they all have different methodologies as to how they calculate the rank of a university. But they will take into account things like patents, industry, income, the number of Nobel Prize winners or field medalists. They tend to be more in the science and technology space. And if you look at that top 100, most of it is built not around the arts and humanities and social sciences. It is built around science and technology in the medical sphere. And I think that pattern will continue. And I come back to my earlier point. These governments have been funding these universities not because they want those very strong music departments and classics and archaeology. It's because they're in the business of nation building and they want elite scientists, engineers, doctors, and so on. So I think that's the driver and that's their focus. Does that stymie them as institutions? Probably. Yes, it does. But that, I think, will come in time. As those institutions mature and develop that confidence, they will be more, I would like to think, more willing to invest in the non-science and technology disciplines. Wow.
Thanks, Dave. I can appreciate the logic around students, international students, moving for things like the rankings and the prestige and the facilities and the top professors that you might get at the elite institutions. But I'm wondering also about broader factors, social, cultural, political, even environmental factors that might motivate international students to move to a particular location to study and then potentially stay on and live. Mm. Everything from, you know, clean environment to social stability to level of multiculturalism. So I'm wondering how important those factors will be over time, and then also where Australia sits within that. Does Australia still retain some kind of pull, even if our academic institutions are declining in relative terms? Is there something about studying and living in Australia that may endure in terms of attracting international students?
It's a really good question. I think the pull factor will remain. Australia is a very attractive destination for a variety of different reasons. And those other factors that you highlight are factors that people desire. So that will continue to be the case. What we will see, however, is there will be a diminishing of countries like China in particular, who are very rankings-conscious markets, that when they start seeing more elite institutions closer to home, perhaps within their own countries, will look to those being viable alternatives. There's a cachet to studying in the West, and so that translates into better job prospects, better marriage prospects, that there will continue to be that. But my argument is that will diminish over time. Within 10 years, definitely within 20 years, there'll be far fewer students from the likes of China. Now, that may be replaced by other nationalities. Because if you think back to when the sort of the largest exporter, if you will, students back in the 90s and 80s, China was Malaysia. The Malaysian government was sending thousands of students to top. And after their currency crisis of 97, I think it was, the tiger economies, they couldn't afford to do that anymore. It just so happened that shocked the international student pipeline was masked by the rise of and so it's quite telling that it changes over. So it may be, you know, parts of Africa, let's say, where you've got some pretty wealthy individuals, and if that continues to grow, certainly in the UK, they keep talking about a real big market, which wasn't the case even 5 years ago.
Thank you, Tayyip. Very interesting talk. You talked about, in particular, leading institutions in Singapore. Mm. And yet, people that I work with in Singapore find that they have great difficulty in recruiting effective graduates from these universities, they still are finding that the international pool of applicants is much more attractive to them than the local graduates, despite the prominence of their, or the new rising prominence of the universities. Would you like to comment?
Again, it's a very good point. So elite institutions don't develop over the space of 10 years. And Singapore fast-tracked that notion by essentially gaming the system. Right? How do you achieve the maximum ranking points for research collaboration or for internationalization? They knew how to game those rankings and rose through that. So they have credibility in that they are actually doing some fine research and so on. But when we look at their education, their learning and teaching in particular, and in terms of the skills that they're imparting, in terms of the experience that they're giving their students, we still feel that we have a much better, more rounded offer for our students. I'm not saying, I mean, I think I hear the same comments from industry here and indeed the UK, which say, you're not producing job-ready graduates. And, you know, there is now a trend. I just saw that Google announced last week or the week before that it would now accept people without a degree, so long as you took their online courses and passed them. If you did that, they would consider you for interview. The top four accountancy firms in the UK now say, we do no longer require you to have a degree. So long as you sit these assessment centres, we will take you on that. And so there is a worry, and there's a debate going on within higher education, which is saying, what is our role here, folks? Are we trying to produce job-ready graduates? Or are we in the business of developing students' intellects and making them well-rounded individuals? And it comes back to that earlier point that I made, that there was a blurring of a line between vocational education and higher education. In the UK, what were called polytechnics were converted into universities. I think you had something similar here as well. So Curtin was, before. So there was that blurring. I think there may be that separation that will emerge from that. We often talk about the fact that the vast majority of the world's leaders are actually people who didn't study science or technology. They studied, the humanities and the social sciences.
Samina, for the last question, please.
Thank you very much. A wonderful discussion and your point, but I was thinking, if I get it right, what you're really saying is economic development has created a push for these countries to build educational institutions. And they're really focused only on the STEM side and not on humanities. When I look at it from Australian point of view, all the problems that we are having with the government's decisions, to me it seems our government is mirroring that. And I think I can see at one level that they're trying to compete with these countries or their educational institutions. But I wonder what the impact on the society would be. Because if we keep on doing that, we may not be consciously promoting authoritarianism or subservience to whatever is there. But by undermining humanities and social sciences, we are creating a new generation that would not have that capacity. And second question, we seem to think about these regional countries as the source of income because we get their students.
Yes.
But we don't look at them as the source of knowledge. Is that something to do with the cultural superiority complex that we have in Western countries? Where anyone who is not, excuse my language, white, and is not in that country is not really worth engaging with. So do we really need to change our leadership and our academics thinking about it to really get a different approach?
Right. So let me take the second point of view, part of your question. Yes is the answer. We do need to change our approach. I think it is happening anyway, and we're being obliged to engage with these top universities that have typically they have academics from across the globe as well now. So you'll have those networks and you'll feel comfortable engaging as you do. You don't think necessarily of the institution as much as the individual professor or researcher that you're collaborating with. And if you happen to know them, if they happen to be from the same country as yourself, it makes that collaboration that much easier. And so that's why, you know, Singapore has been very successful, because it has a very multinational academic workforce. China, less so. India, even less than that. But that's changing. And so there certainly is that understanding that those institutions, certainly in STEM subjects, have developed capabilities that are superior to our own. Coming to your point around that sort of superiority complex, it still exists in the social sciences. And that's because, as I said, those elite universities in the different Asian countries are not actually focused in those non-STEM areas. And so that will perpetuate for a while. Senior administrators within universities are very cognizant of that fact, that they need to continue to collaborate to enhance their own institutions, and so that too will continue. What was your first question? I've forgotten. Yes. Well, I don't think are we mirroring them because of what they're doing? You know, if we look at the latest changes that the education minister has introduced that are probably going to become legislation, yes, we're now going to be requiring, we'll get less funding, federal funding for humanities. We'll be requiring students to pay more. But the government will cap how much that contribution is. And they're wanting to promote vocations that will enhance and grow the Australian economy out of this forecast recession. Does that make us weaker? I just think it's that moment in time. These things are often cyclical. At this moment in time, it just so happens that there is a greater belief that STEM subjects, with things like AI and machine learning and robotics and mechatronics and so on, data analytics, that's the future, folks. That's what you need to be studying. It's a bit myopic, is my assessment of that. And I do feel that, UWA or Melbourne's approach of having that broad education is the right approach. But it's not being pursued by the rest of the sector. You know, there is a razor-sharp focus on a career at the end of a degree. Right? I'm studying law because I want to be a lawyer. I'm studying engineering because I want to be an engineer. It's that black and white now. Whereas, you know, when you went to university, when I went to university, I didn't really have a clue, but I wanted to explore and understand and gain a deeper understanding of the world. I studied PP, politics, philosophy and economics at Oxford. Absolutely loved it. It's the broadest generalist degree there is. And the fact that you could dip into those different areas and specialize if you wanted to was fantastic. And so I'm a big fan of that model that we have here at UWA, but I can also see that there's a change in the winds, and now there's more push towards named degrees, because people want, you know, they're judging the book by its cover. You know, so I was chatting to our head of music conservatorium, and he said we've now introduced a Bachelor of Music that actually has one fewer module of music than the Bachelor of Arts, and yet they've seen a rapid increase in applications, simply because of the degree title.
Well, look, on that note, fascinating tour of the horizon in the last hour and a half.
Oh. Okay. Well, as Thayyib was talking, I kept thinking of a visit that James and I, we went to Uzbekistan year before last. And what I learned, even though, you know, through the Center for Muslim States and Societies, we constantly learn about what happens or happened in Muslim-majority states. What I learned was that there was a time when those places were the centers of learning. And a lot of people from around the world would actually go to those places and learn. And at one level, the fact that the West, in fact, learned from the Muslim background countries and then regained or gained a position that finally pushed the academic power to the West. I think the more you were talking about, I kept thinking it's not academic power moving East, it's academic power coming back to East. And I think at this time, we do need to start cultivating the same attitude that people had at that time. That if there is a place where there's knowledge, or if there's a place where there's funding available, for example, Uzbekistan, but also Baghdad when it was created, we should be open about sharing with them, learning from them, and then giving them our ideas. So in a way, I guess, it was a really great way of listening, the way you were presenting, and I think we need to start thinking about what's happening today. Probably has got a history somewhere way back, and in that I think either because it's COVID-19 effect or whatever, but I think you opened up a new way of looking at education and connections across boundaries. I share your concern about how the focus on one way of learning, even though James is sitting here with his mechatronics and robotics. But he's a more well-rounded husband and an expert. But I think there is a concern that we all need to think about. But putting that aside, I think it's been a wonderful, wonderful coverage of the issues, the context in which what we are seeing, what we are seeing, and its implications. And not just simply for Australia, but for the wider world, but also for the Western world, that so far has had that sense of having more knowledge than the rest. So for that, in my capacity, both as the Vice President of AAIAWA branch, fellow, thanks to during the time when Sue was the president and the director of the Center for Muslim States and Societies, and on behalf of everyone else, I really want to say thank you very much. Now I know why he's known as an effable.
Sure, yeah, probably. And we've got
us. Yes, and there's a gift.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you have to explain what it is.